The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our first live show of 2014 for the Space Show. As you know, I've been in New York for 10 days, and we had a great series looking back at space for the past decade with all of our end-of-the-year review programs over the past decade, but it is really terrific to be home and to be back live, and we have a terrific show for you today where we're going to look forward, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. You're welcome to give us a call. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient. Let the phone ring. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And then you can also continue to use email, which is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, but all of you have permission to download the shows and freely distribute them. Remember, a 90-minute show is roughly 40 or 42 megabytes. Let me know if you have any questions on how to send that around electronically. You can get our podcast through gigadial.net. They're on our website, both of our newsletters. We thank Andrew for their great podcasting service. And please do remember, we're in iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places as well. And if you're using an iPhone or a Droid smartphone, it's very easy to pick up our podcast on your phone. If you have any questions about doing that, let me know. I have yet to hear from any of you out there using a Windows phone, so I don't know how easy it is to pick up our podcast on a Windows phone. I'm waiting for someone to tell me that they use a Windows phone, and it's either easy or next to impossible. So please do give me that feedback so I can pass it around and share it with other people. Do go to our website, thespaceshow.com, and our detailed newsletter gets uploaded Sunday evening. It has all of the details of our programs for the coming week, guest bios, and it's the only place where you'll find a future events section for our show. Please note that for tomorrow we have two programs, a 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. AIAA program. They have a big, important technology conference coming up that we're going to talk about with their new director, Sandy Magnus. And then at 6 p.m., I know that's an unusual time, 6 p.m. California time, a special classroom show. We're going to go back into some of the issues that came up in questions from our recent classroom radiation show with Dr. Jurist and Dr. Jim Logan. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website, or you can easily download the show. Check out our Space Show store. You'll see it up near the top of the site. It's called Gear. And then remember the most important button, support the Space Show. We are a nonprofit 501c3. If you do donate to us, you do get a federal tax donation. We're a California public benefit corporation, so the same is true for those of you paying California taxes. And if you do have any questions, check out our nonprofit site, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We appreciate your support. It is what keeps us on the air, and we're looking forward to a great 2014 with all of you for One Giant Leap and the Space Show. And then finally, remember, we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security, and you can get much more information from them on their website, www.swfound.org, and check them out. They also sponsor our webinar series, so you definitely don't want to miss that when we have our webinars. Today, I'd like to introduce to all of you Dr. William Halal. He's Professor Emeritus of Management, Technology, and Innovation at George Washington University in Washington, Washington, D.C. He's an authority on emerging technology, strategic planning, knowledge innovation, institutional change. He has worked with General Motors, AT&T, MCI, Blue Cross Blue Shield, International Data, DOD, the Asian Development Bank, many foreign countries and government agencies, foreign companies and government agencies. And he also did a substitute for Peter Drucker in giving a talk to 2,000 managers not too long ago in 2000 at the Los Angeles Coliseum. And his work has also appeared in many different technical journals such as Nature Biotechnology, California Management Review. His full bio is up on the website, so you can read about him. But it is interesting to note that he is the founder of TechCast, a web-based system that pools the knowledge of experts to forecast breakthroughs in technology, social trends, and wildcards to assist decision-makers in changing the world. He also has space experience. He studied engineering, economics, and social sciences at Purdue and at Berkeley. Previously, he was a major in the Air Force, an aerospace engineer on the Apollo program, and a Silicon Valley business manager. And he serves on the advisory board of World Future Society as well as other organizations. He's won many, many awards, and we're really honored to have him with us. Doctor, welcome to the Space Show. Happy New Year to you. And in doing pre-show emails with you, you kind of took space and said, let's divide it in near term, which would focus on commercialization and tourism, and then later, longer term, which would be moon colonies, Mars, human spaceflight, solar satellites, contact, and star travel. So starting with the near term, what do you see for all of these efforts for space commercialization and tourism, both suborbital and orbital?
It's a new era. It's just amazing what NASA has done by the COTS program, you know, the program that was set up about 2 or 3 years ago after the commission that recommended that they abandon the shuttle and focus on launch or make commercial launches to low Earth orbit. It's just amazing. They've changed the whole industry. Commercial space is alive and well. Tourism is going to happen in a year or two. And I think it's the beginning of a very exciting period in space travel.
Do you think so NASA's kind of controlled by Congress, we all know that. Do you think they'll continue to sort of step out of the way? I don't know if that's the right wording or not.
I think so. I think it's showing success already. It's only been 2 or 3 years, and there's enormous success. There are like dozens of different companies that are doing different aspects of this, everything. They're planning, you know, low-cost transit to low Earth orbit. Of course, that's where the attention goes. But they're doing everything, talking about flying people around the moon, exploring the moon, putting fuel deposits around the solar system so that you would eliminate the problem of carrying all that fuel into orbit. It's just amazing what's happened in 2 or 3 years.
How do you see China, which seems to have the most robust program around, maybe other than us, what's their influence going to be on the American programs?
Well, I think they're going to apply continual pressure to force us to compete. China is the third major space power, Russia and the United States, and now China. So they're a new entry into the game. They just landed something on the moon. I think it was a robot.
Right, it's moving around, although its location
right.
Seems to be questionable. But they got it there, and it's working.
Yeah, they've got, you know, millions of engineers in that country available to do this kind of thing.
Probably all trained at your alma mater, too.
That's right.
But I guess that's the story for another day, right?
Right. The thing that impresses me, it's reminiscent, I think, of the when the Western Frontier was opened up 200 years or so ago in this country. And there was all that territory to be explored, and the federal government just let people go at it, and they settled the West. And that's kind of what's happening now. The government is just making the conditions right for space exploration by individuals, and people are going at it. It's like the Great Western Frontier.
Do you envision a space race, a competitive thing with China like we had with the old Soviet Union?
Well, yeah, I think that's inevitable. I don't know if it'll be hostile, but sure, there's definitely competition between China and the United States, the two major global powers, and they're going to match us in economic clout in about 10 years or so. Sure.
10 years is the timeline.
Something like that. I'm not sure of the exact number, but yes, it's a major force in the world, and it's going to become an even bigger force. In fact, you know, the United States is going to have to work hard to keep up with these other countries. We have not been doing well in many things. As you know, as we all know, the gridlock in the political level doesn't show any sign of dissipating. And it's disappointing that this country has not been able to do very much in terms of big projects. I was struck by the opening on your show when you repeated the lines of John Kennedy when he announced the trip to the moon.
To the moon, right.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. I was so glad to hear that in your opening. And it's too bad we can't do that kind of thing again. We could. There are wonderful opportunities in space for growth, for economic growth.
Well, you know, half of my audience, or maybe more, has more of an allegiance to the emerging new space community than, say, to traditional space, and they don't want any government space projects. So they would be happy that we can't do a big government space program anymore because they think that that is what took us down a bad path and led to all of the problems that face the space community and all of that. What do you think about that? Do you think the private sector can really do it on its own, or is it a joint effort, or what?
Well, you know, that's a perennial issue, the role of the private versus public sectors. I don't think anybody wants to see the government exert great control over any industry, really. But there always has to be a need for government to organize an industry and to guide it and to encourage it. So I think there's a role for the government, certainly, but not a direct role, a role of encouragement and creating the regulatory framework and what they're doing now, supporting these companies that are starting private ventures. They're supporting them, and that's a good thing.
What about building rockets like the big government SLS?
I think that's over. I think you're right. I think your listeners are right. I think that's part of the past.
Part of the past.
Yeah, I think so.
That'll be interesting to see because, you know, as you know, many in Congress want to hold on to that no matter what.
Yes, they do.
And, in fact, they've got proposed legislation to keep it from ever being killed.
I know. And people in the space community think that the follow-up to the shuttle program that Congress approved is really loony. It's just not very workable.
Do you think these commercial companies like SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, X-Corp, you know, for even the suborbital, do you think we'll see space tourism really take off and flourish in the coming years?
I think the entrepreneurial spirit has been unleashed, and it's a marvelous thing. It's a reminder of the creativity of ordinary business people if you give them an opportunity.
Short of jumping into colonization, which you've got in the second term that we're going to talk about, many see that what we really need to do is lower the launch costs dramatically and build a cislunar Earth-Moon transportation system so that commercial markets can start to be expanded upon and even exploited down the road. Do you see us actually having an Earth-Moon transportation system at some point?
I think so. I think it's a question of time. Yes, and the costs of spaceflight are dropping dramatically. SpaceX expects to lower the costs of a launch by 100-fold. And people are talking about reducing the cost to launch a pound into space from I think it's $10,000 today to like $10 a pound. So this is a new era.
Absolutely, and What do you think of the? There's another revolution going on, and it's kind of on the small side. But from where I sit, I see probably more activity with CubeSats and NanoSats on the private entrepreneurial side, even though they're small. I just see no barriers to entry or very few barriers to entry.
Sure.
And that whole industry has just really taken off like a wildfire in Southern California.
Right. Yeah, and it's really a problem. There's so much space junk up there, and they're just going to add more to it, that it becomes a danger with all of that stuff flying around in space.
So let's talk about space junk for a minute. Do you see resolutions to that? I mean, there's a lot of talk about it.
I don't know. It's a good point. I know NASA monitors all the space debris up there. I could imagine somebody developing kind of a space sweeper, you know, a big device that a satellite that goes up there and sucks in all that stuff and uses it as raw material for something or other. At some point, it's going to have to be done because the space is becoming so crowded that it's really risky. I think it's dangerous.
Here is your first email question. Is Joe is in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, "Do you differentiate between the potential success of suborbital tourism and orbital tourism, or do you think they're both about equal in terms of their potential?"
Well, I think the suborbital flights are just a way to get started, you know, dip their toe into the waters, kind of the way the first manned flight that we made was suborbital, and then it was an orbital flight. So, yeah, I think the suborbital flights will be followed within a year by an orbital flight. That's what we're focusing on at TechCast. If I can just say a little bit of what we do,
It's
TechCast Global, and we forecast really everything in technology, about 80 different technologies covering all fields. And we've recently added social trends and wild cards. So we cover the entire environment for decision makers. And we do that by gathering all of the background information we can on all of these things. But there's always uncertainty, even after we do all that. And that's where our experts come in. We have 150 experts around the world. And they resolve the remaining uncertainty in these forecasts by giving us their estimates. And the system crunches the numbers so that we calculate the forecast, the mean, really, of all of these experts as it changes, you know, constantly, really. So it's the forecasts are updated constantly. And that's where we get these estimates. Our estimate for space tourism, an orbital flight, a full orbital flight, is about 2015. Virgin Galactic is now talking about their first flight in this year, 2014. And our experts think that in a year we will see a full orbital flight.
Probably by SpaceX?
No, I think by Virgin Galactic, I think.
That'll be interesting. They'd have to have a vehicle to do it with.
Well, I think their existing vehicles will do that. I don't think there's a problem with their existing vehicle, is there? I'm not aware of it.
Yeah, their suborbital vehicles can't go orbital, and in fact, they finally admitted that they have hybrid engine problems with their suborbital vehicle and that they are going to replace
it. Oh, really?
Yeah, they are eventually now on the record as saying they're going to replace the hybrid engine. The problem with hybrids is they don't scale up very well, so it causes more problems than not when you need more delta V and more power. But they can't. The difference between orbital and suborbital is huge. The only ones that I know that really are thinking down the road, and I don't know when they might do it. Boeing could do orbital with their CST-100 on top of an existing launcher if they really did get them human approved, you know, like an Atlas or a Delta.
Uh-huh.
Falcon with the Dragon, they claim it has
right.
been, you know, human approved and designed from the get-go, although it hasn't been tested yet for a human spaceflight. But they've talked about orbital tourism with a Falcon down the road, where you might take two or three or four laps around the Earth, you know, something like that.
Sure. And there are other companies that are planning trips around the moon.
Yeah, the Russians, I read pro and con about it, but I'd love to see it. Yeah, I'd love to see it happen. I think it'd be really fun if they could send a couple of just private people around the moon and, you know, let them recreate what happened back on Apollo 8 when we orbited the moon. I think it'd be a really cool trip.
Yeah. And, it's really going to be interesting to see what the media does after a group of tourists comes back from a space flight.
Well, what do you think the media would do? You think they'll jump on it? Do you think they'll wait?
I think so. I think it's going to be big news, and I think it's going to spread. I think there's a good chance it'll ignite a real wave of interest in this, and the industry, the commercial side of space, will get a big impetus as a result.
I think if Virgin or SpaceX are the companies that do it, they know how to work the media so well, and as we were talking before the show, there's no finer worker of the medium than Branson himself.
Oh yeah.
And the PR that Virgin will get will just be, you know, spectacular.
Or Elon Musk, he's a superstar.
Yeah, same thing. So if those two companies are the ones to do it, I think the media will just, you know, bend over backwards.
I think so. Elon Musk has really caught the attention of the world, I think, with his bold ideas. And he's such a young, attractive man, shown such success. Between he and Richard Branson and, you know, dozens of other entrepreneurs who were going into this business, a lot is going to happen.
Now, if they ever get, if Bigelow can ever launch his inflatable private space station,
well,
I think
they have. I think that's been proven to be successful.
The models, he needs to have a real ride to launch the full scale versions. But then you have a destination for these guys,
right?
And now you've got a whole different ballgame. I mean, I think there'd be endless numbers of people wanting to spend 7 or 10 days on a Bigelow space station.
Sure. Yeah, the imagination of Bigelow is going to be the Amazon.com of space. I think he's into everything.
I think so. I'm hoping that he can get those rides to deploy his space stations. That's what he really needs, and then he needs, of course, to be able to get the people up to it. So, because he's not in the launch business at all.
Yeah, that's right. It's the inflatable habitats.
Here's another question from you. This is Alexandra, is in Seattle, and she says, space station commerce has really taken off in 2013 with cases and with the onslaught of the small satellites and the modules going up on the space station. Do you see the space station turning into a commercial entrepreneurial paradise?
The International Space Station?
Yeah.
Depends on what you mean by that. It seems to me it's been a big success to have that up in space for, gosh, it's been up there how long now, 10 years?
Functioning for about 10 years, yeah.
Quite amazing, I think. And I think they will find increasing functions for it to perform, because it's the only proven vehicle up there. So I think it will play an expanding role. I don't know if it'll ever be private, though. I think it's more like a mall, like the role a mall might play, you know, in the economy, a place where different companies might hang out and do business and perform various parts of their mission.
Well, kind of like a business park.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll remain controlled and supported by the international space community. I think that's a good role for it, and that's important. I'm very impressed with the idea of depositing fuel around the solar system. I think that's, you know, this whole infrastructure is being built. Almost every aspect of the space economy is being worked on right now. You know, the fuel deposits, the launch vehicles, the housing, everything. It's quite amazing. So we try to forecast when commercial space will be established in these various functions. I don't think it is now. And we think it'll take a while. It'll take maybe another 10 years until it really becomes a functioning economic infrastructure. But that's reasonable, I think. This is a big challenge, an enormous challenge.
Do you forecast what you think the economic contribution to the economy of the U.S. might be in 10 years coming from commercial space?
Yes, we forecast, among other things, the year when these targets are reached, and we also forecast the saturation, the market saturation, when the industry matures. And I'm looking for the numbers on space. It's about, globally, it's about several trillion dollars, the estimates that we get from our experts.
Now, are your experts from outside the U.S. as well? Or
they're all over the world.
They're all
over the world. We qualify them online. They take a little quiz to test their competence. We look for their qualifications, you know, their degrees, their inventions, their publications, that kind of thing. And we have people from all ages, all disciplines. So it's very diverse. But the thing they have in common is they are all thought leaders. They are people who have a creative mind, and they're involved in the advancement of various technologies and these revolutionary changes. So we think they represent the leading edge of thought. They're not authorities in the sense of, you know, some stuffy professor or government official who is out of touch with things. That's the stereotype of experts. The crowdsourcing people say that experts are always wrong. They're thinking of those kinds of experts. Those aren't the experts that we focus on. We focus on thought leaders.
Do you find that there's abundance, might be the wrong word, but an abundance of supply of space experts around the world?
Well, I don't know about that, but we have no trouble getting people to volunteer to serve as experts on the TechCast project. It's open to anybody, and we get hundreds of people applying. And they're not paid anything. They just get the visibility and the access to all of the information. And these people just apply. We invite people as well, people that we think are especially competent, but most of them just see the site and they're interested and they apply.
What is the website for more information?
The present site is techcast.org, and the new site that'll be up in just a few weeks is techcastglobal.com. A big expansion in our operations. We're expanding dramatically to include social trends and wildcards and tools, strategic tools.
Do you, in commercial space, do you see most of the activity coming out of the United States? Is it divided up around the world? Do other economies participate, or are they mostly government and state programs?
I think it's global, and I think a lot of it is entrepreneurial. A lot of it is government. It'll take some time before those other countries can wean themselves off of their government programs, but I think they're going to go private as well when they see what's happening in the United States, the enormous payback from this investment. I mean, what SpaceX did in just 2 or 3 years is really quite amazing. And the plans that Musk has, I mean, what bang for your buck? Why would any government pass that up?
Well, that's a good question to ask. I can't answer that, but I think they do in many ways. But
there are about six or so spaceports being built around the world, various countries,
right,
which is a measure of how much interest there is in this. You know, like the one in New Mexico that Virgin Galactic is using.
You have another email question, and listeners, it is Sunday, so you can use the phone line, 1-866-687-7223. So Ralph is in Denver, Colorado, and Ralph says, in terms of commercial space and the space tourism industry, what do you see as the biggest challenges going forward in 2014?
In 2014?
Uh-huh. or going forward from this point, what would be the biggest challenges for commercial space and space tourism?
Well, the real big challenges are things like solar satellites. That's the long-term stuff. That's what's really exciting, I think. Solar satellites and putting a manned colony on the moon, a human landing on Mars. Those are beyond the commercialization and tourism that is occupying our attention now. Over the next two or three decades, that's where the attention is going to be, I think, moving out into the solar system. And creating the infrastructure so that that commercialization will follow, like fuel deposits, that kind of thing.
So in terms of the near term, what would be the biggest challenges? Is it regulatory, or what do you think?
Oh, I think it's just getting these private companies getting their act together. You know, they've got to learn how to do this stuff. It's tough. They're going to have to make. They're making a lot of mistakes, and they're going to have to really make this work. And I think that's very hard. It's an enormous challenge, and they're doing it at a fraction of the cost that NASA has ever done it with. So I think for the next few years, we're going to see more of this more mundane activity, getting these various entrepreneurs' systems working and bringing costs down and reliability up and getting the public involved. So the big stuff isn't going to happen for the next few years, I don't think, while the infrastructure is being built.
So you were on Silicon Valley. Is this the time to be investing in these entrepreneurial, new, smaller startups, or would you wait and see?
Well, I think space is a growth field. I can't help but see that. I like the solar satellites. Solar satellites, there are three or four countries that are planning to build solar satellites over the next 20 years or so, and they have such potential for providing clean, cheap energy, and they could employ just hundreds of thousands of people. It really could be a new frontier, an economic frontier. And the old industries are not looking very robust, because we all know that employment is drying up in many present industries with automation. More sophisticated artificial intelligence systems are automating jobs. They're all of the jobs in principle that most of your listeners are engaged in, you know, they're intelligent jobs, white-collar work, professional jobs. In principle, a lot of that could be automated by advanced intelligence systems, and that's one of the big challenges today, one of the big dilemmas, what comes after knowledge. We're automating knowledge, and so that was the frontier for the last 20 or 30 years. And now if we automate knowledge, what is there beyond knowledge that is offers economic opportunities? And space is one of them, I think. And that there's payoff. You know, solar satellites would be extremely productive. They'd pay for themselves.
But you think that's still pretty far out there?
That's about 20 years out. There are some countries that are planning to have something up by 2020, I think it's Japan or somebody. I'd have to look. But I think those are just enormous undertakings, yes. And that's where the opportunities are, in these big projects. Space is big projects.
Okay, so that goes back to the role of government, doesn't it?
Well, there's a role for government, but I don't think it's the role that government used to play in the past. You know, I think government can just be the organizer of these projects. And the companies will do the creative work, the development.
What about
the operational work?
Joining together with international coalitions, is that?
Sure. Absolutely. The space station is such a success for that very reason. What a marvelous thing that all of those people from various countries, those astronauts, go up there and spend time together and share the costs. It's been wonderful. You know, space is too big to be done by any one country, I don't think. In fact, that's one of the payoffs of space over the long term. I think we may see it since it transcends Earth. Space, by definition, transcends Earth, and so I think it may serve as a focal point of activity that would bring nations together and joint projects. And really big space, like when we, in 20 or 30 years, when we start thinking about leaving the solar system, that is going to require a concerted effort by the globe, people around the globe as a whole. The projects are going to be so enormous that no one country could possibly handle them.
If you were an investor now, would you be looking to make space investments today, or would you be deferring for another year?
I would invest in SpaceX. I think I think there's a really good chance he's going to make this the General Motors of space.
Well, let's hope he does better than that. I don't think anyone wants to see him bailed out and bought out of, you know, by the government. We'll call it Government X then, I guess. Right.
Right. Well, I think that's the big issue of our time. What is the relative role of government versus the private sector? The private sector can't do these things alone because you need some kind of an organizing focus. Somebody has to provide leadership and vision and get all of the players working harmoniously. And that's the role for government, I think. That's why the economies that are thriving today have strong governments. You know, Germany, China, Singapore, they have strong governments. And Americans have, I think, Americans are on a anti-government, I might call it a binge, that I think is a little misguided. You really can't do an awful lot without the government playing some role.
Well, that's true. I guess the fight is over how big that role is, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or what it controls or something like that.
Right. And we're going to have to define that role in this country. Other countries have resolved those issues, but for Americans, that's still a live issue, and we're hammering it out right now. We have to define the relative roles of government and the private sector. They both have an important part to play.
Joshua is in New York, where I just was, and he said, to what degree do you think the general public has to be on board with space development for it to flourish?
Oh, I think you can't do it without the government. I mean, that's one of the reasons that the space program has lagged in this country. People became a little bored, really, with space flights after the first big accomplishments. They lost interest, and that was passed on to their representatives in Congress, and that's why the funding dried up. I think the public has to support space in order for it to flourish. I think so.
Is there a magic percentage, like you need to have 10% of the public on board or 40% or something like that?
I don't know about that. But I do think that this is not going to work without public support. I think the public is going to support this, though. I'm eager to see what happens after the first tourist flight comes back and people are interviewed by the media. That's going to be a pivotal moment, I think.
Would you take one of those first flights?
Oh, absolutely. If my health were at it. But, you know, in time, I do think that the promise of making this as convenient and safe as air travel, I think that's a fairly feasible goal. I think that could happen in 10 or 20 years. That fairly ordinary people could take a space flight.
Well, that seems to be their goal. So
yeah,
and we're hoping that they can, you know, fulfill that and meet those purposes.
It's the beginning of a spacefaring nation, a spacefaring era.
Now, what is your assessment of Congress and political leaders and key deal makers, you know, pivotal policy wonks, as they say? Are they on board with what we're talking about, or is there still a big resistance level that has to be dealt with?
Well, I hear a tension between the new role of NASA versus the old role. I hear a lot of people showing nostalgia for the role that NASA used to play when we had space shuttles and all of that sort of thing. And some people long for that. They think that it's necessary to provide it serves a catalyst for the industry. But I don't think that's accurate. I think that's really not likely to happen. I think Congress as a whole likes the idea of the private sector taking over space. Living in Washington, that's my sense. They accepted the Augustine Commission's findings willingly. They thought this made good sense. Turn the private sector loose to bring the costs down, get NASA out of it. Let NASA just facilitate the process.
When you talk space among your peers and in the Beltway, is there any remnant of the giggle factor with space development, or is all that gone, long gone?
Well, I think it's gone. That's the way people talked about space tourism just 5 years ago.
Right.
It was, oh, my God, you're not going to put that forecast up on your site, are you? I mean, people thought it was, you know, it was right up there with, and people still feel that way about alien contact. That's one of the forecasts we have.
You have going. A forecast for alien contact.
Yeah, alien contact. And a lot of people still think that's just ludicrous, that it's silly to be even thinking about that. There's no evidence whatsoever that life is out there. It's so far off that it's not even worth thinking about, that it's just a random process. But that's not true. Progress is being made. The telescopes are advancing roughly as fast as electronics are, according to Moore's law. They're doubling in power and reach every couple of years. They're getting very sophisticated, things that go far beyond Hubble. And everybody's excited about the exoplanets that have been being discovered, 2,000 or so at last count, and 100 or 200 of those are roughly like Earth. So progress is being made. This is advancing. I think it's going to happen. But that's a long-term development. Our experts associate. Well, we're changing that. It's interesting. We forecast different ways. Some things we just forecast when they will happen, if there's a well-defined trend like space tourism or commercial space. But contact is different. There's a random element to contact. It could happen any time. And so we've changed that into a wild card. We now are going to forecast that as a wild card, where the experts estimate the probability that it's likely to happen. And I think we're going to find that the experts think there's a pretty high probability, well over 50%, I think. We'll see. We don't have complete results yet from our experts. We've just started to get the experts' data. And right now it's too preliminary to say, but I think we'll find that they will agree that more than 50% probability that contact will be made in the next 20 or 30 years, something like that.
We need to take our break, but I can't go without asking you if the contact is estimated to be friendly or hostile.
It's hard for me to imagine how an advanced civilization would be hostile. The sophistication that is required to communicate across space is so enormous that I think that's going to be a benign civilization. That's my guess. But I could be wrong, you know. That's what's so fascinating about it.
Well, would we be considered hostile? Because we have the technical capability, I guess, to initiate or maybe participate in the process of
That's
alien
right.
contact.
So at our stage of development, I think we would be hostile. That's right. But I think this planet is changing dramatically. We're armed to the teeth and all of that. And I don't think that's functional. I think
not functional. We're just totally dysfunctional.
Exactly. And it just doesn't serve any purpose. And one of the things we study on TechCast is the big transformative changes, what we call the global mega crisis, the confluence of these various interrelated crises like climate change and energy and financial instability, cyber terrorism, all of those sorts of things. And what we've learned is that the present system just can't survive. The world has to make a transition to some kind of a different global order if we hope to survive. And it's going to require collaboration among various nations and so forth, with lots of individuality, of course, and freedom, and still conflict, of course. But the present world order is not sustainable, I don't think. And so my guess would be that in 20 or 30 years, the planet Earth is likely to become one of those more sophisticated civilizations that is relatively benign to contact from alien species, not as we are now.
Interesting. So does the nation state disappear?
No, I think nation states, all of that remains, but some kind of coordinating mechanisms, I think, have to be developed to create the basis for civilization. We don't have the basis for global civilization at this point. Countries do whatever they choose. Wars, conflict, illegal migrations, all of that stuff. We're using the space as a sewer for these toxic chemicals that are being sent into space. So that's just not sustainable, I don't think. The people we talk to seem to agree about that.
Let's take our pause here. We're a little beyond halfway during the program. And listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes. And again, the phone number for those of you who would like to call instead of email, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, listeners. This is part two of our Sunday program. We're looking into the future for space with Dr. Halal from George Washington University, Professor Emeritus. And we have a caller on hold, so rather than my asking you what I intended to ask you up front, let's go to our caller, okay?
Good.
Hi, caller. Who are you? Welcome to the show.
This is John of Fort Worth.
Welcome and Happy New Year. This is the first time I've had a chance to talk to you in the new year.
Yes.
Hi, John.
How's it going? I would just like the point I would think about the commercial space. If you look at the commercial aviation, like the jet aircraft, so much of this was driven, particularly in the jet age, by the derivative from the military programs. I mean, the B-47, yeah. B-52 bomber programs provide the technology for the 707 and subsequent aircraft and so forth.
Right.
I think that somebody's new space has it backwards. I think that the means to get to space isn't where the commercial industry ought to be some primarily focused. They ought to be focused more on what to do once you get there. The government should be trying to develop the means to get there, and because that requires a lot of investment that has no immediate return. But eventually, if you do develop it, it'll have a lot of return.
Yes, that's right. Well, you're right. What are we going to do there? Well, one of the things that's interesting that's happening right now is harvesting asteroids. It's absolutely amazing that there are two or three efforts going on right now, John, to tether an asteroid and to strip it of mine it for minerals and materials, and they're estimating that a single asteroid could be worth trillions of dollars in raw materials. So I think we don't know yet, but we're going to find important purposes in space. And solar satellites are another. Yeah, that's just dying for somebody to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Practical.
Right, and you need to have the transportation capabilities and get the cost down. And my thinking is that, for instance, what SpaceX has basically done is it's mined the technologies that were already developed by government programs and been able to do it in a very efficient commercial model,
right,
which allowed them to tremendously reduce the overhead. And
yeah,
they didn't have to deal with all the political thing of putting something in everybody's district. They could just do it the most efficient way,
right,
to build it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think they've developed any new inventions or technology breakthroughs. It's state-of-the-art. They've just done it more effectively the way the private sector can. That's right.
Yeah, because they didn't have the limitations
There may always be an important role for NASA and the government in doing these really tough, long-term projects. That's what you're implying, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, because the thing I'm getting to is, okay, take the shuttle, for example. In reality, what it was basically a prototype of a concept, okay, which was probably falsely advertised. And of course, because it was flown so little and because of certain catastrophes and everything, the way the government reacts to everything, it ended up becoming incredibly inefficient. But what we really need to do is go to the second generation and third generation of the technology where we can build a really reusable spacecraft to get the cost down. And I think, I mean, granted, what the shuttle itself wasn't there yet. It was, it's just a prototype of an idea, but it did demonstrate the capability to return at least part of a spacecraft and land it and reuse it.
Right. Well, but a government program will always be a single program, as opposed to the private sector will have maybe a half dozen different entrepreneurs trying to solve the problem, and you come up with better solutions. So I think there is a definite advantage to the private sector doing these kinds of things.
But who would have the capital to really build something like that that's purely private? I mean,
Elon Musk is planning to go to Mars, you know, have SpaceX take us to Mars by himself.
Well,
these companies, I think, will have the capital.
Giggle factor on that one, but sorry.
Pardon me?
I mean, I think he can build a rocket. I think he probably can build a Falcon Heavy eventually. But I think essentially it'll be duplicating the kind of technologies we already have and doing it cheaper, more efficiently.
So, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So you're a proponent of having the government continue to play its role, I guess.
To a degree, particularly in developing the means. And once the means are developed, I'd like to see the government sell it to commercial enterprises to actually do many of the applications. So that's more my thought thinking.
Sure.
Most industries
have developed. The government started these industries by undertaking this long-range R&D projects that nobody else could undertake, and then they just spun that technology off to the private sector.
Yeah, because imagine if we had shuttle 2 and then shuttle 3 and got to an efficient, reusable system, and then the government said, okay, private companies, you can go ahead and buy some too, or you can have an umbrella corporation that will rent it to you or whatever.
Sure.
Then you could have a large number of these vehicles and have all kinds of different commercial projects going on to boost solar satellites or asteroid, whatever you want to do, to get into orbit and then. That's my thinking, anyhow.
Sure, yeah. No, there's a lot of merit to that. There is an enormous advantage right now to having like a dozen different companies trying to solve these problems. You come up with very different solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And the government can't do that, I don't think.
How about the fact that the economy is so stressed out now, there doesn't seem to be either the will or the reality of money available for the government to do what John is talking about?
Yeah, that's right. NASA is really starved for budget. They have to work very hard to try and allocate funds to get things done. And that's going to remain. It's hard to imagine how these deficits are going to go away. And that's happening around the world. Governments are running deficits around the world.
So the scenario that John would like to see is no longer affordable, at least in the near to short term, right?
Well, unless governments decide that a certain project has merit, like Brazil is trying to develop a spaceport because they're located near the equator, and that has advantages for launch. So some countries will invest huge sums of money in strategic projects that they think will give them a big boost into space. But I think that's going to be the exception. I think my sense is that the private sector is demonstrating its advantages in doing this for the most part. I think John's right about the research and the pilot projects that are needed. That is the role that I think government will continue to play, but that is a limited role in my view.
Well, my thing is that the government has plenty of money. It's just how it chooses to spend it, because largely you have political leaders that at the present time seem to have a real deficit of vision on these kind of things.
I mean, yeah, that's right. They could spend the money if they wanted to.
I'm not particularly impressed with the people I oppose.
I'm sorry, John. I cut you off. Sorry.
I said, as far as political leaders, I'm not overwhelmingly impressed with the people I support, let alone the people I oppose.
Yeah. Well, I hope this is just a temporary thing, this gridlock. I mean, it can't go on. I can't imagine how the country could remain stalled like this for much longer.
Yeah.
I can imagine it going on indefinitely.
If it does, we're going to be in big trouble without a functioning government.
Yeah.
Well,
there is one other issue we might want to address, and this is not necessarily a positive thing, and it's a mega trend issue beyond this, and that is, civilizations have existed throughout history that rose to great heights within their own technological level and then fell, with the ancient Egyptians and the Persians and so
Roman,
forth.
All of them.
Roman Empire. The question is, our civilization, if you want to say, probably launched with the Renaissance and is now reaching a global proportion, if you will.
Yes.
And but the question is, will we also fall as a civilization, or will we be continuous? See, that's another issue we got to watch. That we could go through a dark age, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's the global mega crisis issue that I mentioned earlier, if you heard it on the show. The world is facing a historic challenge right now. The present system is not sustainable. It's not going to work for much longer, especially when, as GDP continues to grow, global GDP will double in the next 12, 15 years or so. So all of these problems will increase proportionately. And so the energy and environment problems and all of that, and the financial instability, that has to be addressed, I think, if there is a future for our civilization. I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, I'll clear the line and see if somebody else wants to join the conversation. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, John.
Listeners, that opens up our line if somebody wants to join the conversation. Nice way of saying it. 1-866-687-7223. Please do give us a call. So before we came back from the break, you were sort of thinking tourism by 2015, commercial would get developed around 2020 or so,
right.
And then interstellar and going deeper 2030 and beyond.
Well, interstellar is very long term. That's 2070, 2080 or so. But the medium range is a Mars mission, a moon colony, and solar satellites. Those are the medium term projects that look very promising, I think.
Now, do any of these, including a Mars colony, lend themselves to private exploitation? Is there going to be a return on investment, or are these more likely government villages to start off with?
That's a good question. I don't know. There are some private things going on. I know that. There's just so much going on. I'm trying to think of the names of some.
Well, the two Mars ones are the flyby with Dennis Tito, Inspiration Mars.
Right.
And then
the
Dutch reality TV show project, Mars One.
Yeah, Mars One. Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to work out, making that a reality. What do you think of that, making that a reality TV show?
Well, I've interviewed Bas Lansdorf twice, and he's a very, very polite guy, and he's very polished. I mean, he's about as polished as of anybody I've ever talked to in my life.
Uh-huh.
For PR and media. He has an answer to everything, even if the answer is in Looney Tune land. And I think it will never see the light of day. It'll never launch a rocket. They just did identify about 1,100 people out of their couple of hundred thousand that sent in video applications to be part of their first crew. But I think the human factor and the absence of technology to put humans on Mars and keep them there will is just not going to be developed in time for them to seriously do anything. And
uh-huh.
I also suspect that there's no virtual reality TV show that has even come close to financing, raising the money, showing the profits that they need for their project. They just don't produce that much money.
Yeah.
They don't produce $6 billion, for example.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just it's a bit of a fantasy. But there's so many – that's the whole point, though. There's so many interesting groups that have come together that want to try their hand at these things, like Golden Spike, which is
– that's Alan Stern's project to go to the moon with private – now, that's plausible if – companies will really pay $1 billion or so and want to put a couple of astronauts on the moon for some project. Why not? I think that they could pull that off.
Yeah, and there are a lot of companies that are reserving time on Virgin Galactic's suborbital flights because it's a convenient way for them to do research in space. So there's a we're just going to start. I think in the next few years, starting to find the commercial applications of this. You can't tell in advance what the commercial applications will be. It's almost impossible.
No, I agree. I would say in 3 years, our commercial space vocabulary will be demonstrably different than what we know today.
I think that's true. Yeah, it's just beginning.
And we don't know what's going to be down the road.
I don't think that's possible. I mean, for instance, when the North American continent was discovered 500 years ago, people had no inkling what that meant, none whatsoever. It was just a mystery to them. That's roughly worse fate.
Yeah, if you were forecasting back then, there'd be no way you could come up with 2013. You know, what we would be doing, what technologies would have happened, what would have been developed.
Exactly.
Even Nostradamus couldn't have done it.
Exactly. It was just a whole different reality. What we're doing at TechCast is relatively short-term, working within the existing paradigms for the most part. But when you have these big paradigm busters, like a new continent is discovered or a whole new dimension, space, it's very hard to do that. The assumptions could all prove wrong.
Well,
that's what's so exciting about today. It's being explored right now. All of this is being learned, and it's going to change.
Here's another email question for you. This is Jules in Phoenix, Arizona, and say many people talk about the potential negative effect of an early onset accident in the space tourism industry. Have you looked at that to see what kind of impact a bad accident would have on space tourism?
That's right. Well, my guess is that it's kind of like space, air travel. People know that it's dangerous inherently and that there will be big disasters, and they just take that in a stride. I think that's smart people seem to understand that, I think. And it will happen. You're exactly right. It would be a terrible thing, but it's amazing we got past the destruction of the Challenger flight. It took a few years to grieve over those people, but it went on. It's just going to be a part of this reality, I think.
I have said on the show, let me bounce this off of you, I think it depends who has the accident. So, for example, if... And I'm not asking for this to happen, listeners, so don't say I want this to happen, but were Virgin to have an early accident, I think because of their experience with trains and airlines around the world and having accident groups ready to go for and knowing how to manage PR and CNN when they stick a microphone in your face, I think the ability of Virgin to withstand that is going to be a lot better than some of these upstart, smaller entrepreneurial companies that don't have any experience in that world.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And
right.
And having just flown on Virgin America from New York back to here, I can tell you that they are a master of PR and imaging and impressions. I mean, you know, I told you we were 3.5 hours late. The crew came down. The captain came down, sat with us in the departure lounge, made announcements, told us what was happening, talked to us. And my friends who were coming back with me were on United coming out of Newark, and they had the same delays that we were having, and they couldn't even find a United representative. So I just think Virgin really knows how to deal with publicity and PR and people, and I think that will flow over to Virgin Galactic as well.
Sure. Well, what's the difference, do you think, essentially, between Virgin Galactic and United? What makes that possible, do you think?
I think Branson.
I think it's him.
Yeah, I really do, and I think he sets the standards and the manuals and the protocols.
Right.
And this is, I mean, he's a publicity hound himself, as we all
right.
know. And I think he really cares about this. And I think, you know, United is kind of like Old Space, if we want to say Old Space versus New
right.
Space. You know, this is the way we got an
sure.
accident team. Yeah, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, we're
yeah, Branson is kind of the Steve Jobs of space.
Right,
the
Apple computer.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And he wants to communicate and relate with his customers.
Yeah.
And
his image is very important to him.
And I think he's directed his crews to be very personable.
Right.
I think that's different than a lot of the
right.
The other service. I mean, Southwest Airlines is out of the same mold, for example.
Right.
You know,
right.
so we'll see. Maybe I'm off base here, but I just think Branson is so skilled in these areas.
Sure.
And Elon Musk is the same way.
Exactly.
And,
well, that's the genius of the private sector, that these talented individuals come forth and they organize the industry. And I'm not sure the government can ever do that.
Oh, I don't think so either. I can't imagine
no.
NASA doing anything
no.
like Virgin
no.
Galactic or Virgin
no.
America could do or Virgin any of them. I just don't see it.
No. My years working in the space sector taught me that those are huge bureaucracies, and I don't see that changing.
I don't see, you know, Boeing doing that. If you were flying, you know, on a CST-100, I don't think they would have near the, you know, well, you can look at what they do with the Boeing jets. I mean, you know, they're very professional, but they're not out there like a Virgin is or Branson. It's just a different world.
It takes a young entrepreneur, I think, to bring that kind of talent out. I think you're right. Big institutions are not good for that kind of thing.
No, I mean,
Boeing isn't much different than NASA in that sense, I would say.
Probably, although I think they're probably a little bit more innovative than NASA.
A little more, yeah.
You know, and the same with Lockheed. But, I mean, we're talking about huge, huge operations, and if you want to move their stock, which is what the investors want, right, the fiduciary obligations, these companies
right.
are so hugely capitalized, you can't move their stock on space tourism revenues.
No.
It's too insignificant.
This is still the early stages of the new space world, and it's going to take some time before we see the potential here. It's hard to find other frontiers for modern economies to explore, really.
Do you
think about it?
Do you see humans in a big way wanting to live off Earth, say, either in an orbiting space station or on the moon or on Mars? Do you think there'll really be a push for humans to want to leave Earth? And assuming this is all feasible medically and everything
sure,
like that,
sure.
let's zero all that out.
I have no doubt that some people will seize the opportunity. Look at what Mars One did. They advertised for volunteers to take this one-way trip to Mars, one-way trip, no coming back. and they had, I think, 200,000 volunteers.
Right.
200,000 volunteers.
Globally, and they cut it off. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
I think it is amazing.
I have no doubt that there are many people who will leap at the opportunity. Because, you know, we're all different. Some people are terrified by it, but some people are exhilarated by it.
Can't wait to get off the rock, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like the people who wanted to go west or who wanted to go to the new world. They still exist.
Exactly. And we should feel fortunate that there are people like that. There are people who want to take on these risks.
So do you think the government should try to support that and encourage that, or just stay out of it?
I think that's the proper role for government, to act as a catalyst, as a facilitator, but not to actually do the work itself, to organize people into a coherent workforce, you know, the way NASA did for big projects, only not quite as controlled as, you know, like the Apollo program. They had thousands of contractors, maybe hundreds of thousands all over the world. And that was, I think, a good role for NASA. And this would be a similar role, not quite as controlled, but there's a role for the government in organizing the private sector, I think.
And
that's what we have to find, that partnership between the private and public sectors.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Happy New Year,
Doug.
To you, too, Doug. How are you? Good hearing from you again.
Sure. Thank you. Likewise. I don't know. Is it a possibility that all of those 200,000 volunteers from Mars One is just, they've got in-laws that they're trying to get away from?
Say
that again?
He said, do you think that of those 200,000 people that they're trying to get away from in-laws? But, Doug, you heard the shows with Boss, and I asked him about that, and he said that they would not consider any applications from people wanting to go to Mars to get away from something here, either a wife, in-laws, a bad job, a criminal record.
Yeah.
He wants
yeah.
people that want to save the world.
Yeah.
So if you assume that the majority of the 200,000 applications are from people who want to save the world and not run away to something from something, then I would say they're not trying to get away from in-laws. But I don't know. I don't know who sent in the video. You never sent one in, did you?
No, but, you know, I was just joking here, of course.
I don't know. I would think a lot of people would want to leave Earth to get a new start, you know, for some reason or another.
Well, honestly, I mean, you know, like the rest of you, I'm not expecting that it's going to succeed or that's going to come into reality. I think that there are individuals who would, for the sake of making meaning of their lives, to do something significant for humanity, I think they would be willing to risk even a very high chance of failure, actually. I think they're all.
Sure.
I mean, there's people who have been willing to risk their life for what I would consider to be much less.
Sure.
What do you think of his future scenarios of going to the moon and propellant depots?
I don't know about deposits in the solar system. I think probably within the Earth moon system and cislunar space, I could imagine that, and perhaps one on like Deimos. But I think further out in the solar system, I think that's quite a ways down the line. But overall, yeah, I think depots make sense at certain locations. So I would agree in the medium term. So what I was calling about is just sort of weighed in on what John, the previous caller, and you guys were discussing about the role of government. And I guess my concern, and this is where I think the analogy to the military airlines in World War II, I mean the planes in World War II leading towards the airline, is I think that there was there wasn't a big gap between the size and the function of the planes in World War II, or I should say shortly after World War II, and the needs of the commercial airlines. So they could be modified for that purpose relatively easily. my concern is I'm not convinced that the commercial industry is really chomping at the bit for a heavy lift vehicle. So my concerns would be is that if the government sets the standards, you know, the criteria for the heavy lift vehicle, that it may not translate well into what the commercial needs, you know, really are.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
So, so as I see it, I think there is a place for the government, and I think it is facilitating, but I think it's more of an equal partnership rather than the government taking the lead and then simply selling the technology. Rather, I think the technology ought to be developed with private industry, very much in the way that COC has been done, to where the government set the standards. We need cargo and crew delivered to our International Space Station, but they really leave it up to the participating companies as to how they're going to design it, so that the companies are bearing in mind what comes after commercial resupply to the International Space Station. Well, is it tourism? Is it, telecommunications satellites, GEO? Is it circumlunar tourism? Is it, you know, going to Mars? They can think about the technology and design it to fit their future commercial needs, and the government is served along the way. And so it's sort of a real win-win situation for both groups.
Yeah, I think that's well stated. I think you're right. And you get the diversity of innovation from the private sector that you would not get from a big government project. That's what you're seeing now. You're seeing a variety of approaches to going to low Earth orbit.
And I even regret that the heavily lift vehicle was not competed. It wasn't, you know, I think your Boeing, Lockheed Martin, ULA, SpaceX would have been willing to develop that. If it had been an open competition for that development, for that contract. But it wasn't. It was, let's make sure it's based on shuttle technology. And so it's serving, you know, that shuttle technology is serving government needs in like the 1980s or even 70s. And it wasn't really developed, with the commercial needs driving the development in parallel. So I'm doubtful that the heavy lift vehicle is going to serve much of a commercial role.
Well, I think that's the prevailing sentiment among many people in the space industry, that it's more of a government boondoggle than anything else. Congress just wants it.
So it comes down to question of, well, does it serve a government need, and can that government need be only served by the SLS? Or, you know, is there an alternate path? But it seems though we're committed to the SLS, and so I think, sort of with John, I think he said before, it's, you know, we've got it, let's make the best of it. But I'm less than enthused about it.
So you both dismissed what the experts say, and that is, if you want to do beyond low Earth orbit human missions, you need the heavy lift rocket, whether it's SLS or something else is another story. So if you're going to go beyond low Earth orbit with humans, doing it with smaller rockets raises the cost and raises the risk. It's not that it can't be done. So the question is, how do you go beyond low Earth orbit with humans at some point down the road into the future? Is it with something like an SLS, regardless of who makes it, or do you relegate yourself to using smaller rockets, more launches, and higher risk?
Well, I actually agree that we need the heavy lift or equivalent capacity to go beyond the Earth-Moon system. I personally, as I look over the numbers, I personally don't think it's actually necessary within the Earth-Moon system. But if you're spending a large amount of time in interplanetary space between Earth and Mars, I think the radiation issues are going to mandate, in my opinion, going to mandate enough shielding. You know, the RPA-5, as was mentioned before. And that is clearly getting you beyond Falcon Heavy level, at least for a single launch. So I see a need for the capability of a heavy lift vehicle, but my feeling is we're not going to be going to Mars this decade. And so I think
no.
that in my opinion, I actually support the Obama administration's initial decision to hold off on building heavy lift vehicles for at least 5 years, recognizing that that does mean the loss of the shuttle workforce, or, you know, basically that loss. But I think that there's enough alternatives, including competing heavy lift vehicle contract, plus other approaches to getting propellant in space in a top-off situation where you just have one launch with the dry, mass, and then a second launch that docks and transfers in a single transfer. I think that would be able to get you to Phobos, probably. Probably not to the Martian surface. You don't need more than that.
Doug, do you work in space?
No, I'm a physician.
Oh.
Yeah. But I dabble.
Yeah, you really seem to know it.
Do you guys remember way back when with the Augustine Commission? I remember I did a show with Bob Zubrin, and he talked about following the testimony of Augustine with Elon Musk. And they were talking about options. Remember, at the time it wasn't SLS, it was Ares 5.
Right.
So, you know, it was Ares 1, Ares 5 Constellation, all of that. And he offered to build the government a heavy lift vehicle somewhere around the order of Ares 5 for a fraction of the cost of what they were proposing for Ares 5 and subsequently for SLS, and he was blown off and dismissed. And I remember Zubrin talked about that testimony before Augustine at length on the space show. So I guess we'd have to go back to around 2009 to one of Zubrin's appearances to hear about it. But Elon thought that he could come close to what Ares 5 was for a fraction of the cost, and was willing to commit to building that rocket for the cost that he was talking about before the Augustine Committee. And I think, you know, that even if he had had some cost overruns, he'd be far cheaper, and we would have probably been there by now over and above what we're doing with SLS.
Sure. Well, that was before the commercialization was
really
going
kicked
on,
into. Yeah.
I'm not sure people were prepared.
Well, he had COTS. The COTS program was going on, but nothing else at the time was going
on.
Yeah.
Attitudes have changed, I think, just the last two or three years after seeing what the private sector has done in space.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we were at that point in decision right now, I think there would be a whole lot more credibility. I think SpaceX would have a whole lot more credibility if, you know, do we think SpaceX can build a heavy lift vehicle now? You know, they're just, I think, signed or something an agreement with Stennis to go ahead and develop a 660,000 pound force methane rocket. And so in my mind, they're clearly looking actually to proceeding with the development of like a Falcon XX. That's my initial take of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if that conversation were to take place today, there would be more receptivity to that. I think you're right. That just shows how much attitudes have changed in the last two or three years, I think.
And COTS has had a whole lot to do with that. You know, the delivery. You know, one of the biggest, most exciting events sort of surprised me, but that was the first time the Dragon docked to the International Space Station. It just shows you that incredible reaction that we all saw. It just shows you that, you know, there's a lot of support, I think, in the public for commercial, American commercial companies, you know, making progress and doing what the government can do, but as the government is able to hand it off to the private sector, even if they're footing the bill, you know, that I think that, you know, there's a sort of groundswell of support for that. And I think NASA should keep its eye on the stuff that you cannot make a business case for, like I would say going to Mars, although maybe Elon thinks he can make a business case for that. But, you know, pushing further out, doing the really harder stuff, but really trying to hand over just as soon as possible the things in the Earth moon system that have some potential for a return on investment.
Well, I'm not sure Elon Musk expects to make any money on the Mars mission. I think that's just a personal aspiration.
Well, he might spend his last million making it happen.
Well, but then he can retire there, and I guess the cost of living on Mars will be pretty low, right?
Once you're there?
Once you're there, yeah. Once you're there and the hab is there, and, you know, I guess it's going to be pretty affordable, so maybe he won't need all of his billions by then.
It's such a mind-altering thought, you know, the fact that people could live on Mars. It's hard to get your mind around it.
Well, and for how long will they live on Mars? But you know, I hope I'm around to see it happen. I'd really
well,
like
I
to see.
I think it would require terraforming the planet, I suppose.
Well, that's the long term problem. I would definitely won't be around to see that one happen.
I know.
Look, we can't even build a third runway in San Francisco by filling in the bay. How the hell are we going to get permission to terraform Mars? Can you imagine the complaints on that one?
That's right.
So this is.
Let me just throw in at this point. I think terraforming Mars is a lot more cost effective than full terraforming of Mars.
The what for? What is more cost effective?
A para terraforming.
What is para terraforming?
This is basically extending greenhouses into ever increasing, you know, covering the surface area, so that you don't have to transform the entire atmosphere, the entire planet, but you just use the ice and you keep extending out your living space, basically.
Oh, I see. Would that be in domes or something?
Yeah, or the equivalent.
Sure. Yeah, that's probably right.
But you'd have to address the radiation issues. I mean, in both cases, you have to address the radiation issues.
Sure. Well, you know, that brings up one of the big issues we haven't touched on, developing life support systems for all of this. I mean, that is an enormous challenge. I don't think we can do that yet. I mean, I visited the biosphere in
Tucson.
And you know that was a failure. Really, we couldn't really get that biosystem working. So that is an enormous challenge right there. Just developing systems that will keep people alive in those habitats.
Yeah, I visited biosphere too, and I know a little bit of history. I think it's maybe unfair to call it a failure. They, you know, with their eight people or whoever, they didn't succeed. But the problem, I think, was the oxygen was absorbed into the cement. And so if they were to do it over again, they would solve that problem from the get-go.
You think it was the cement?
That's my understanding.
Uh-huh.
Dave, do you know anything about it?
I don't know.
No, but the guys who did it are the couple that have Paragon Resources, which are the leading life support company doing this for space as well as for ocean stuff in Tucson. You know, Tabor McCallum and his wife, I forget her name. She goes under her own name. But they're the ones who did Biosphere, and they learned an awful lot from it. And most people, like Mars One, even Inspiration Mars, has turned to Tabor and their group for life support on their proposed missions to Mars. And I am of the school, like you, that we're not there with this technology yet. And there are now some people that are saying it is so hard to have life support that they ought to use open life support systems rather than closed. And they're just get a huge, humongous rocket and take the stuff with you that you need. And I don't know how you can do that, but they're saying that's easier to do than to try to make closed-loop life support systems.
Well, there's a bit of complexity here. On one extreme, there's complete open-loop where you don't...
Well, like
you know,
the space station is what they're talking about, more or less.
No. If I understand correctly from the previous show, it was actually complete, basically no recycling at all. It's basically... If you have to have the equipment to recycle, that equipment could break down on Mars and you can't fix it. Therefore, we should carry all of the water and all of the oxygen that you need for the entire trip, like in scuba gear type stuff. That's what I heard on the show. And it seems to me as though, no, I think especially recycling water, I mean, we do it on backpacking trips practically. You have the pumps and be able to purify water. I think we could recycle that. I think probably basic recycling of the oxygen is doable in a safe enough sort of manner. It's the rest of it, especially things like the food, I think is much more challenging.
Sure.
Well, I hope we are around to see it all fall together. That's all I can say. They need to get to work to start making it happen.
Let me just make a couple of comments before I sign off, because I know that is this an hour and a half show?
Yeah, so we're already over the time limit, but that's okay. Go.
Just a couple of things were mentioned earlier. I think the 2015 figure for Virgin Galactic is probably, if you were to look back with what your expert says, I'm guessing that was actually probably the suborbital flight. And it probably won't be Virgin Galactic. That will be the first to do orbital flights. It's probably going to be SpaceX. They'll do the first commercial orbital flight.
Are they planning that, do you know?
SpaceX?
Planning an orbital flight, do you know?
A manned orbital flight, yeah, as part of the commercial crew development program with NASA. So I think they're looking at 2017. David, can you confirm that?
Yeah, 2017 seems to be their date for taking crew to the space station.
There's some mention of a possible extra milestone that NASA could allow, and that would be for a private private crew, not going to International Space Station, but to orbit and then back. And so that could be 2017 or maybe 2016. But they haven't approved that as far as I know, so that's only a possibility. And the second thing is my personal belief is I think that solar-powered satellites, I think, are a fairly challenging thing to make the business case for, to make it profitable. I know there's a lot of smart people that say otherwise, but I'm inclined to think it will probably have to wait until there's in-space material resources, things like metals and silicone, before it would really become cost-effective on a large scale. I can imagine maybe a pilot demonstration or a dedicated sort of serving government or military needs for electricity in just a limited sort of area where electricity is really expensive. But I just don't see it as being replacing our need for electricity probably until maybe mid-century, if at all. That's my take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could be right. There are about three or four projects that are being planned, I think.
I think at best those are demonstration, and I hate to say I would be a bit skeptical. I just want to wait and see if even those demonstrations are launched, because I don't know, they could be a pretty small scale that could be launched in a single rocket, so maybe,
yeah, right,
maybe somebody to do that. But even if they were to do that, I'm not even expecting an actual something being sufficient electricity down, even soon after such a demonstration. Definitely, uh-huh. That's just my opinion.
Well, I think robotics is an important element in making those big projects feasible. The work would all be done by machines.
Yeah, but it's really the cost of mass to LEO. Even if you have reusable rockets that you need to turn around, and the expense of that, when you're competing against solar farms on Earth, even though they have less amount of sunlight throughout the day, it's just really, really cheap, and it's getting every day cheaper to do that. So it's going to be tough to match that with space solar power.
Yeah, solar satellites on the moon might be an alternative, as a matter of fact, because then you have the materials on the moon.
That's true.
To address the problem you brought up, Doug.
Yeah, much greater distance, and therefore the divergence of a beam, but. That's possible.
The advantages are so huge, though, being out of the atmosphere and weather and operating 24 hours a day. It's so compelling.
But finance, the business case is what ultimately decides the large-scale implementation of it.
Right.
So there are distinct advantages. I have no doubt about that. But you just need to make sure it makes a profit for the companies that are putting them up. That's the key thing.
Yeah, well, right now I think the plans that are being considered are being supported by governments, I think.
Right.
Japan has a plan, and India does, China rather. it's just so attractive to so many. It's just such a compelling case.
Yeah, so long as it's not just compelling from a philosophical standpoint, but actually from a economic. I know that we have, like, on average, we've invested something like about $1,000 per U.S. citizen in alternative energy, and yet right now, if you exclude hydro from that, which was going to happen anyhow, but without research, the solar and wind is like about 0.3% of our electricity.
I think it's a little more than that, Doc. I think it's like 2 or 3%. It's been growing dramatically. It's growing like 30 to 50% per year.
I think in the power grid, no, the figures that I look at, it's less than 1%. And the growing dramatically might be on people's homes, but not. I mean, we have, for example, in California at Four Corners, we have this big solar farm, but, we just haven't had much else since then. So I think it's going to remain small until it really becomes competitive, and if there weren't government subsidies for the windmills out at Palm Springs and other places as well, I just don't think business would have done it, certainly not in the 70s and 80s when they were put up.
Sure. Right.
That's just my opinion.
The solar on people's homes is tax-subsidized, too.
Yeah. So it doesn't show a true picture. It's an artificial picture when it's subsidized.
Well, oil is subsidized, too, so you have to compare both of those to draw judgments, I think.
Well, they don't give me a subsidy when I fill up my gas.
No, but the industries are subsidized.
But the industry gets subsidies, gets non-tax benefits.
Right.
And tax benefits.
Yeah, I don't know much about that. I'd be surprised if they get as much benefits as the alternative energy.
Are you kidding? With a depletion allowance, they get huge benefits.
Yeah, it's in the tens of billions a year.
I mean, it's huge.
That's pretty interesting.
Excuse me.
All right. Well, let me let you guys go.
All right. Thank you, Doug.
Sure.
Thank you, Doug.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Real quick, Bill, before we go.
You have very intelligent people following your show, I can see.
Yeah, the space cadets really know the industry and care about it and are pretty well informed.
Yeah, Doug said he's a physician, and boy, he really knows this.
Let's look a little farther out and let's talk about what happens mid-century, going out. What do you see about contact and interstellar travel? Do you see this really happening?
I do. I know it's hard to grasp that now. It's hard to believe it. But the world's going to change dramatically in the next 20 or 30 years. I think we're moving to a mature planet. Scientists call it a type 1 civilization, where the society is unified in some way. And so I think our assumptions about the way the planet works are going to change in the next 10 or 20, 30 years. And the next great frontier, I think, is going to be space. And I do think that it will look different in time. I think 30, 50 years or so, I think that will be a global effort to learn how to make these breakthroughs in physics, the fundamental laws of physics that are necessary to do these kinds of things, star travel and contact and all of that. It's going to require a different understanding of the universe. And though those are enormous challenges, it's going to take global effort, I think. But I think that is where the world is going in the long term. I know that's probably hard for many people to accept today, given the dysfunctional state of affairs, but these things always change. And if this planet is to survive, I think it's going to look very different in 20 or 30 years.
Does government need to play a role in helping us along the way?
Absolutely, sure. Our government has to facilitate all of this. It has to get the players working together nicely. Yeah.
Has to get everyone to play nicely, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
And what do you think? You really think we're going to have contact, that life, intelligent life is out there?
Well, the odds are so overwhelmingly in favor of it. If you look at the Drake equation, it takes all of these different factors into account. the probability of a planet like Earth, the probability that life has appeared there, the probability that it's matured at the same time that we've matured as a civilization. You still come out with, when you put reasonable numbers into the Drake equation, you come out with hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of possible planets that do have civilization. So the odds are just overwhelming. The question, I think, is communication. The distances are so enormous that, and I don't think our present ways of communication are going to withstand these advances. I think we're going to learn different ways about the universe, the way the universe works. And I don't know what that's going to be, but it's not going to be the present laws of physics that we know of.
So you think the laws of physics will evolve?
I don't know. It's a good question. There's some scientists who are saying that the laws of physics, the constants, what we call the constants, have changed over time, that they have evolved along with everything else, with the expansion of the universe. That's an interesting point. I don't know. But there's very little doubt in my mind that young people today are going to live in a world that that routinely travels in space. I think that's going to be a reality.
I certainly agree with that. I don't know if they'll travel in interstellar space, but certainly they'll...
Interstellar space is something else. That's true. That's just a whole different thing.
I think I wish we could say that we'll see routine travel to Mars. Do you think that'll be down the road in 2050?
I think the solar system is going to be explored and inhabited, yes. The solar system. Our solar system.
Right.
The various moons, there are like hundreds of moons. Some of them are as big as Earth. There's just so much territory out there, and it's all so different. And it's all accessible.
So do you see us evolving in certain ways where we could actually have a space war?
Well, there you go again. I suppose that's all possible. Maybe I'm optimistic, but I just can't help but shake the conviction that an advanced civilization able to do this kind of thing is going to be benign. It's going to take very sophisticated scientific communities, very intelligent people, great dedication to do all of this, and that's not going to be done by belligerent people, I don't think. I personally don't think that's a realistic fear that would be attacked by aliens, but maybe I'm wrong.
As we close down the show, as we actually approach 2 hours, what should we be looking for now and in the next couple of years to sort of help us shape the world that we've been talking about for the last hour and 45 minutes?
Oh, well, I think the first thing we have to do, I think, is understand this trajectory of evolution that the planet is going through. This life on Earth is like 3 million years old. That is human life. Humans have been around. Humans have been around 3 million years, I think, and it's only in the last few decades that all of this has become possible. So it's really a miracle almost that after these endlessly long periods of time when nothing happens, all of a sudden the Earth comes alive, and we're doing all of these marvelous things. So that trajectory has to play out. It's unstoppable. It's bigger than any of us, I think. And so I think the world's going to look very different in just a few decades. All of the assumptions, or many of the assumptions that we hold now, I think are going to just look silly, kind of like the way we look at Elizabethan England, and we just marvel at how backward those people were. I think that's about the way we're going to see today in, say, 30 or 50 years.
We'll be museum relics.
Will be what?
Museum relics.
Yeah, our children will wonder, my God, what were they thinking?
We'll be in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They'll have a whole wing and dedicated to life in the 2013s or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, the rate of change is so unprecedented. It's just amazing. I mean, knowledge, the ability to harness knowledge on a global scale is such a breakthrough. Who would have even thought of that? You know, 30 or 50 years ago, the idea of managing knowledge would have been unheard of. That would have seemed a crazy idea. You know, people just didn't think in those terms. And that's the way I think we're gonna feel about what's coming in 30 or 40 years, that these things are going to shock us. They're unprecedented. And we're just you and I and Doug and John are just kind of groping into the darkness here, trying to make sense of it.
Do you have a manual or 10 basic steps of how to prepare for this?
No. Well, I think just understanding this transformation would be a great step forward. Well, I don't think most people understand it. I don't think most people understand the enormity of it, the fact that it's happening so quickly, and it's going to be such a massive change in the world. The industrialization of the entire world, all connected.
And
you know, we've got six billion cell phones being used today. You know, the world is being connected. It's a remarkable thing.
Have you thought about writing a short manual for us all?
Well, that's kind of what TechCast is. We do our best to anticipate where these things are going for decision makers and policy makers. That's what I think we have here.
Fascinating. So I think maybe the older one is, the more do-it-yourself manual, step-by-step, we need to adapt, because there's a lot of really issues that, you know, having come out of the 40s and the 50s, that this just doesn't sound right to most of us.
What doesn't sound right?
The way things are evolving and how priorities are changing and things shifting. I mean, it's so different than the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, for example, for those of us that have been around. It just, you know, it's hard to grasp it, as you said.
Exactly. It really is. That's exactly right.
It's easier for my kids. Yeah, it's easier.
They lived in a different world, and the difference between that world and this world is going to be pale in comparison to the difference between today's world and the future world in 20 or 30 years. It's going to pale in comparison.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciated talking to you and getting insights from you and getting a glimpse of what is likely to evolve and unfold around us, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, that's right. It is. It's bigger than us. I think that's one of the first things we have to accept, that we're not in control of this process. It's the planet. The planet is evolving, and we are participants in this process.
Like it or not, we're along for the ride.
That's right. It's been great being on your show, David. I thank you so much for inviting me on.
Thank you. I hope we can chat and talk down the road with you again. And I hope you have a great coming year and an easy adaptation into the future.
Yes, that's right.
For all of us.
That's a good thing to wish all of your listeners.
That's right. I think that'll be
my adaptation into the future.
I think that'll be my New Year's greeting now for everyone else.
That's right.
Thank you. And listeners, remember, we have two shows tomorrow, 2 to 3 p.m., with AIAA Executive Director Dr. Sandy Magnus, former astronaut, talking about an upcoming technology conference. Boy, you can ask them about changes in technology that they're witnessing. Unbelievable. And then our classroom show on more radiation tomorrow, 6 p.m. California time. And everybody, have a safe remainder of the weekend. If you're on the East Coast, keep it warm. And it won't be as cold as those football players today up in Green Bay, but it should be fun. Thank you all, and thanks to our guest, Dr. Halal, and everybody have a great week coming up. Goodbye from the Space Show.